All right, everyone. Can you hear me? This is working, right? All right. Thank you all for being here. Good afternoon. Hope the convention experience, conference experience has been good for you. The issue we're dealing with is not so good, I realize, but this is the kind of thing that organizations like ACEC have to contend with from time to time, both the good stuff and the bad stuff and challenging things. Needless to say, we've been talking a lot about this for a couple of years now, certainly for the last couple of months, and pretty extensively at this conference with our executive committee. You know, certainly before we all left to come to San Diego is when USDOT came out and kind of surprised everybody. I think everybody was assuming that they would wait for the court proceedings in Kentucky to finish and we would get final guidance and decisions from the judge. And then the agency would go forward, and they I guess chose to get out ahead of the judge. But we've had some good conversations since I've been here with our executive committee. Had a good conversation with the state executives that run the ACEC state chapters, and really talking about sort of the substance of what we know about this so far, and as well as the contours of what we feel like we need to do going forward. And there's some urgency to that going forward piece that that you all can help us with. Talked a little bit about it with the small firm roundtable on Sunday. And, you know, as we were huddling, whenever it was, Sunday evening or Monday evening with Linda, our CEO, you know, she felt that, you know, hey, we've had some good conversations. We need to broaden this and create a session kind of on the fly to give other conference attendees to come in and be a part of this conversation and kind of hear about the plan going forward. So again, thank you for being here and adjusting your schedules if you had to do that in order to participate in this conversation. Like I said, there's some urgency to what it is we need to do. The rulemaking came out on October 3rd, Matt, correct? And it's followed by a 30-day comment period. Now, normally when agencies give us 30 days to comment, that means that they don't really care about the comments. They've just kind of decided already, and they're going through the motions. But we want to take this seriously and give them some ideas and recommendations on how to do this in a way that minimizes as much as possible the impact to engineering firms that have DBE certifications. Let me ask the question real quick. We've got a good turnout here, which is absolutely terrific. Just show of hands, how many firms are firms with DBE certifications? Okay, not quite half. All right, and then how many are not DBE certified but still interested and concerned about the issue? Okay, the bulk of the crew. Okay, good, helpful, very helpful. All right, so I guess I should introduce myself. I'm Steve Hall. I'm Executive Vice President at ACEC, in case I haven't met you. Among my other jobs, I run the advocacy side of ACEC, and this has very much been an advocacy issue for the last couple of years. To my left is Matt Reifer, our Vice President of Infrastructure Programs, and Matt has really been driving this. This has started as a USDOT thing since that lawsuit came about, whenever it came about, 2023? And so it's became very centered on USDOT and federal aid programs and as they apply into the state. So what we're going to do this afternoon is, of course, you know, when you come to an advocacy briefing, we're always going to have slides for you. And so Matt's going to kind of give you a little bit of background as to how we got here. The multiple court cases that have sort of fed into this, starting with the Supreme Court's Harvard decision. We'll talk a little bit about what we know about what the interim rulemaking says that we need to do. And then we want to talk about, you know, next steps. Like I said, we have a 30-day comment period. We want to get some recommendations in the next 30 days. And we want to involve you in that process as part of our working group. You know, these state executives will be a part of our working group. We want to include you, and we'll reach out to other DBE firms. You know, we may be working hand in glove with AASHTO and other stakeholders. We're not the only ones that are impacted by this. And I think there will be some synergy and recommendations that we put forward, as well as other organizations might do. So we want to meet that 30-day deadline, but I imagine there's going to be opportunities to continue to engage USDOT. We've been working to build a relationship with the new secretary and the team over there, and we're going to use those relationships as much as possible to see what we can do to shape this policy. And that's what ACEC is all about. I mean, we don't observe and report. We're here to affect and shape and do things on your behalf to weigh in on behalf of the industry. So, you know, this may be something that is somewhat malleable beyond this 30-day deadline as we and other stakeholders, you know, not only submit recommendations, but sit down, meet with them, talk about some of the challenges. And it may be, you know, in the coming months, this policy kind of slowly refines itself going forward as we learn more. What we want to come away with, we hope, is an understanding on your part of what the plan is, your part in that plan. And like I said, for those of you that that want to be a part of our working group, we're going to have our contact information at the end of the slide deck, so you can reach out to us directly. So with that, let me turn it over to Matt, and he'll do some of the table setting, some of the background, and then we'll come back to the next steps part. So Matt.
Great, thanks, Stephen. Good afternoon, everyone. Am I coming through okay? How about now?
Yeah, okay. And just for both of us, because I think we're trying to record this session, so try to speak into the phone or into the microphone so that that comes through. And by the way, I think we may try to do a webinar once we get back from this to kind of bring in the rest of the nation. So, you know, you're sort of the initial prototype presentation, but, you know, there's a lot of folks around the country that this impacts, so we want to give them a chance to weigh in as well.
So. Yeah, and before I get into the slides, let me just add two other comments to what Steve referenced in his introductory remarks. First of all, and our CEO Linda talks about this a lot, that the power of the Federation and the opportunity for us at the national level to utilize our state and regional member organizations to push out information and to collaborate. And this is very true in this instance where, you know, you have a federal policy and a federal rule, but the individual state DOTs are all going to be, you know, obviously making a lot of implementing decisions. And our opportunity for our MOs and the executives to share information and collaborate on shared priorities and best practices is going to be really essential. So the strength of the ACC is in the Federation, and that Federation structure is going to help us as we navigate this. The other comment I'll make is when I talk about DBE program challenges, and Steve referenced the judicial piece of this, the court cases, the regulatory piece, there's also a third leg of the stool, which is the legislative piece. This is a statutorily authorized program. It has been part of the Surface Transportation Reauthorization Bill since 1983. And it will be ripe for consideration again in the context of reauthorizing the programs under the IIJA. And it's come up at every committee hearing that the House T&I committee has held. It's a high priority for a lot of legislators. Obviously, that will be impacted by the outcome of the court cases, but there is a legislative component to this as well that will have an opportunity to potentially impact and influence. But just again to kind of set the table and provide some background for the conversation that we'll have with you, You know, the legal challenges really started with an unrelated case. Steve mentioned the Students for Fair Admission suing Harvard University over its affirmative action, race conscious admissions programs. And in a landmark ruling in 2023, the court ruled that that kind of approach violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. That precedent then led to a series of other cases applying that reasoning specifically to government programs where there was a race or gender-based consideration. In the Ultima Services case, it was focused on the SBA 8A program. In the Newsyard case, it was specifically focused on the Minority Business Development Program. And whether it was the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment, that same kind of constitutional standard where, and the strict scrutiny that was applied to, discriminating against participants in government programs on the basis of race and gender, and the outcomes there sort of led into the challenges that were filed in the Mid-America Milling case. And I'll say, from an ACEC Transportation Committee perspective, it was really when that Harvard decision came down that our committee first started talking about this, and these other precedents started to come through at the district court level. Even before the Mid-America case was filed in Kentucky, this was on our committee agenda, and we had flagged this as an issue, and we saw looming challenges on the horizon and started the conversations among the member firms about the sort of potential there and what we needed to be doing collectively as an association. So these conversations have been taking place in various segments within the association, including in the committee, even before the legal challenges started coming out. The Mid-America Milling case, which is really central to the disadvantaged business enterprise, was filed in October of 2023. The judge issued a preliminary ruling about a year later, and again, along the lines of those previous precedents, found that race and gender-based contracting preferences were unconstitutional, issued a preliminary injunction, the scope of which was limited. It was not nationwide, and it wasn't to everybody and the entire program. It was limited just to the two plaintiff contractors and the states in which they were operating or expressed an interest in bidding on contract work. And so those DOTs, largely in the Midwest, it's about 20, maybe 25 states, have been working with Federal Highway since that ruling came down to eliminate DBE goals on projects where Mid-America Milling and the other plaintiff were expressing interest in bidding. So that kind of laid the groundwork for the coming regulatory challenges that we were going to see. When the Trump administration came in January, the DOT and DOJ, which is representing them in the case, filed for basically a kind of a change in posture in that lawsuit. And the Trump administration and USDOT basically agreed with the plaintiff contractors that yes, the rebuttable presumption of social and economic disadvantage in the DBE program is unconstitutional. And they proposed a settlement in that case and a consent order that was done in May of this year. So that was the next sort of really significant step in this development. That got a lot of people's attention. There was some misinformation around about that the order that was proposed was circulated as though it was signed and a done deal. So there was even some disruption and sort of chaos when that was filed. But that the order is not final. It is the judge has not issued a final decision. And part of that is because a group of minority contractors and minority contractor associations successfully intervened as direct parties to the case. And they have had the opportunity to file briefs and make arguments defending the constitutionality and the merits of the DBE program there. And so there's no ruling. We've been tracking that really closely, but and we don't really have a timeline or kind of an expected outcome there.
Matt, quick question to that point. I mean, because the final decision hasn't come out, I mean, this is an area where there's been suggested this may be a potential area for a legal challenge in not following, you know, administrative procedures in terms of the issuing of this regulation. I don't think we've seen anything to that effect, but that's one potential early challenge that we may see from DBE firms or something of that nature. So.
Yeah, I think that's right. I would not be surprised to see someone file for an injunction against the rule, arguing that DOT kind of got ahead of themselves before the court case had run its course. I would also note, and I should have mentioned this earlier, when the preliminary injunction came out in the fall of last year, that prompted us to host another online course for ACC members. That's still available, I think, not to be salesy, but just to demonstrate sort of pushing out our education and outreach to make sure. We had a law firm, Nossaman in DC, which has extensive experience in government contracting. Two of their experts kind of did the full-blown rundown and, you know, potential scenarios and what firms and DOTs have to be doing to kind of think about that process. So we're continuing to, again, engage with the members and equip them. And then last week, as you know, DOT published what they call an interim final rule, basically to enact the parameters of the consent order that they have proposed in the pending case. And the key points of that interim final rule, which was filed in the register, Federal Register, on October 3 and took effect immediately. Significantly, every currently certified DBE firm will lose that certification. And every firm will then be required to resubmit and based on an individual assessment of social and economic disadvantage. This follows the way that the SBA kind of reconfigured their 8A program with this personal narrative and evidence of social and economic disadvantage. Unlike the rebuttable presumption that was in place previously, the burden of proof is on the applicant to demonstrate beyond with a preponderance of evidence that they are socially and economically disadvantaged. Until that evaluation is done by the certifying agency, there are no goals, there are no program goals, and there's no counting toward goals for DBE participation in DOT-funded projects. As far as we're aware, there's nothing in the rule, and we haven't seen anything that would mandate the cancellation of existing contracts. Either the direct work for the DOT or as subs, but that's something that we are, you know, continue to kind of flag and try to get more information on. But nothing in the rule mandates that contracts that were awarded under DBE goals have to be rescinded. It would be a forward-going kind of proposition. But then they do not change the other parameters of the DBE framework, which is the personal net worth cap and alignment with the small business size standards. Those criteria are still in place under the interim rule. I won't read through this, but the rule contains, you know, this is that what is required for certification. It's that personal narrative demonstrating social and economic disadvantage under those personal case-by-case kind of circumstances, that individualized proof, and how and to what extent those impediments cause the owner economic harm. So there's that description, but we don't know anything more than that or what that's gonna mean. And then let me flag a few other less significant, still significant, but less significant changes. The rule would replace the terms race conscious and race neutral and similarly gender conscious or gender neutral with DBE conscious and DBE neutral. So the underlying goal here for the DOT is to eliminate basically race and gender considerations and really put the focus and impetus on social and economic disadvantaged. So all of those terms are replaced. They also then amend what states have to do for the goal setting and the disparity studies based on, again, a race and gender neutral piece and just looking at economic and social disadvantage. So after they go through the certification process, then they'll do the disparity studies and sort of capacity analysis of what that new kind of contracting base might look like for goal setting going forward. As I mentioned, the interim final rule was effective immediately upon publication. Then there is this 30-day comment period. And then the last piece, and I've reached out to our contacts at Federal Highways, specifically within the Office of Pre-Construction Services. Separately from the DBE rule, there is within the section of the code dealing with A&E and engineering and design services, there is a piece that mandates consideration of DBE in the QBS competitive selection process. Nothing in the rule updates or changes that piece, but there's that intersection there in terms of the allowability for up to 10% scoring in selection criteria for DBE and the mandate to state DOTs that they consider DBE goals in their program for A&E services. So we're trying to get clarity from them, and they've referred that to their in-house counsel for additional clarification. So we're waiting on additional information there. But obviously that's really important for us beyond just the broad changes to the DBE program. What does that mean for the selection of A&E services? And so, you know, for me and for our committee members and the conversations that we've been having in you know, various sectors within the association, I want to flag, you know, some key considerations or key questions that we've identified, and this will be the launching point for our dialogue and discussion today. First and foremost, we really need more clarity, and there's a lot of uncertainty around what evidence is going to satisfy this new standard. When you submit that, when a firm submits that personal narrative and that evidence, you know, what passes that threshold and what doesn't? What gets you certified and what doesn't? We, you know, that's going to be a piece that we're going to need to work out and get more information on. How long is that going to take? You know, this is not going to be an easy process. It could be very, very cumbersome for, you know, staff limited, resource limited agencies to now go through this process on an individual case-by-case basis with every firm in the market. So that's going to be very disruptive. As Steve mentioned, there's this lingering uncertainty on the underlying lawsuit, and will the ultimate outcome of that case and potential appeals change the framework that we're operating here and the parameters of what is constitutional and what is not? That's a real uncertainty. Will interstate certification continue to be enforced? As many of you know, when the prior administration went through a pretty significant overhaul and update to their DBE certification rules, one of the key points that we brought to bear in that process was facilitating a much easier mechanism for interstate certification. Because we heard from our firms that were certified as DBEs that it is incredibly burdensome from a paperwork standpoint to just keep track of all the deadlines and filing requirements for the firms that are working in multiple states for different clients. And so the idea that once you're certified in one state, that it's basically a rubber stamp in every other state that you are a certified DBE. And we got that enacted in the final rule in 2024. And we would want to make sure that that interstate certification process continues to be as least burdensome as possible, so that once you go through this individual assessment, that you don't have to do that in multiple states, that it is this 10-day, you know, rubber stamp acceptance kind of thing. That's going to be really imperative. And then the last piece where there's a lot of kind of lingering uncertainty is this question about if you're getting rid of the goals and you're getting rid of counting toward goals, what does that mean for the DBEs that are subs to primes, who no longer have goals that they're mandated to reach under their contracts with the DOT? So that's an area of question and something that we're going to need to continue to monitor and track. So those are the, again, near term. These are the things that we flagged where we're going to, you know, potentially need to weigh in with the department and or provide, you know, seek and provide additional guidance to you all. But would love to, if there are pieces that we're missing here, or if you've got insights, you know, I think that's where we're going to go next in this conversation.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I mean, are these the issues that we need to focus on? Are there other issues? You can sort of see the kind of things that we probably are going to want to put into a recommendation letter for the department. And like I said, this is something we're going to want to coordinate very closely with our state organizations. I think I may have touched upon this earlier, but in the Saturday meeting with the state executives, I mean, we were hearing that, you know, DOTs were already starting to lean in and communicate with, the U.S. DOT on potential paths forward. And there will no doubt be some good ideas that come up in the context of our DOT partners. And so is there a way for ACEC to grab as many of those good ideas out there that, again, fall under this general theme of making the transition as easy as possible, as least burdensome as possible? Are there ways in which ACEC can support those state DOT good ideas? And so part of it is identifying those, and then we package them together into a comment letter. So at this point, why don't we, let's open it up for discussion. We've got a couple of folks with microphones that can walk around, and looks like we've got a hand up back there. And again, you know, what we're trying to achieve today is to get some initial feedback, some recommendations, particularly questions that we're not asking or issues that we haven't flagged yet. And then before we leave, we'll put our contact information up because we want to hear from you in addition to the conversations we're having here, because you're going to be part of our working group going forward as we refine our recommendations and put them forward. So, sir.
Chris Diaz with Diaz Yorman and Associates. So on your previous slide, you had October 3rd as the effective date. Does that mean nobody in this room is a DBE anymore, or does that kick in after the 30-day? And I have a second question.
It means, you've all, I should say, the U.S. DOT has directed the certifying agencies at the state level that they need to decertify every firm as of October 3. So okay. Not at the end of the comment period, but immediately.
All right. And then on your last bullet point on this slide, the next slide.
The next one?
Yeah. So the question about what happens to subs on existing contract, doesn't just contract law kick in? We have contracts with budgets and work scopes and everything else, and that does this rule somehow tear those up?
We hope that's not the case. And as Matt indicated before, there wasn't anything in there, even though the rule says you've got to go back and get recertified, there doesn't appear to be anything in there that also says pencils down, you can't do any work on what you're doing now until you get recertified. But that's something that we need clarification on, not just our industry, but I'm sure many industries that are impacted by this. So we're assuming that those existing contracts remain in force and you proceed with what you're doing, and perhaps one of the goals of the exercise we're going to go through is to try to make this as prospective as possible, given the mandate to eliminate that race and gender criteria. I thought I saw a hand up over here. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I have a question. So if there are RFPs and RFQs that are already out there with federal money, with DBE spend, do they say anything about those RFPs and RFQs? Are they going to be canceled, or is it the P and RFQ will move forward with zero DBE goals?
Yeah, it's a good question. It may depend on how the state DOT interprets and applies the guidance. I've seen in one state where they had a sort of QBS competition, but the contracts were not executed, and so the DOT is now saying we need to go back and recompete those without the DBE consideration involved. So there was a selection process, but that is being unwound, which is, that's candidly disconcerting. But again, it may depend. There may be some flexibility or latitude among the DOT on when it stops, you know, and it's sort of forward going, where we need some more clarity on that.
Great question, though, and that's an area we need some clarity on. And again, kind of getting back to that theme of, you know, where are we at a pencils down point, and is this completely prospective, or is existing contracts and solicitations still can still go forward? Hand up over here.
Hello. Okay. Just wanted to touch on the existing contracts with DB goals and subs that are actively working on these contracts. We're hearing through the grapevine that some of our DOTs and agencies are considering issuing amendments to existing contracts to not only do away with the DBE goal entirely, but also the DBE program as a whole. So I was wondering if you guys had heard anything of the realm of that.
I mean, Matt, weigh in here, but I mean, I think the expectation is there will be a DBE program going forward, just different criteria that they're looking at. And Matt shared with me, there was some information, a lot of organizations like ours are putting information out to their members, and it's essentially the same thing that we've put out. The road builders put something out. They added something that hadn't occurred to me, but you know, there is going to be a DBE program going forward. It's going to have different criteria, and it sort of begs the question, does that mean that certain firms that currently do not qualify as DBE suddenly have a pathway into a DBE designation? You kind of have to assume that that's going to be the case going forward, again, depending on that personal narrative and other information.
Maybe a quick update on, as of today, I guess a current RFQ was republished in a state with the DBE goals removed, you know, kind of in active pursuit. So just I think you're right that each state is going to kind of interpret that differently. That wasn't my question, though. That was a freebie. The question or thought, I guess, I wonder on your first one, I guess it's obvious, but I wonder, are you guys sure that I call it the national or U.S. DOT is going to set these new standards so that we have one standard? Because I'm kind of imagining now, you know, every state setting some different pathway, and how confusing that would be for all of our firms. There might be some who maybe want that to happen, though. But are you hearing anything as to, are they going to actually give actual standards and directions from the national level on what this is versus states interpreting it on their own?
Do you mean in terms of what qualifies for certification or setting?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm wondering
so this is verbatim from the rule. Here in this slide, but if you read this, my own view is, you know, there's certainly room for interpretation, and there's some, you know, pretty significant room for subjectivity in terms of what meets that standard of preponderance of evidence for proof of economic hardship, systemic barriers, denied opportunities. So that's where I think you could see some inconsistencies in
latitude
where that standard is for what meets those criteria and what doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, we have this challenge with respect to, you know, part of what we do is FAR enforcement. You know, ACEC years ago got legislation through Congress and signed into law to impose the FAR on state DOTs. So they couldn't cap your overhead. They had to use the federal definition of QBS. And it's fairly clear, you know, the AASHTO audit guide is sort of the guidebook for compliance, but states still have differing interpretations. And so I have to assume that will be the case here. And we may see some, you know, certain states have good policies, And again, our goal is to maybe identify those good policies and try to make them national. But we've also seen a tendency on the part of particularly the FHWA division offices to give some deference to the DOTs and how they go forward some of the things. So there may be some inconsistency, but what we're hoping to achieve is on big issues. You know, Matt mentioned one of them, you know, reciprocity. You know, that there is a consistent national policy. And but, you know, getting back to my earlier point, this may require and end up, you know, we may end up working for some time with the agency and with other stakeholders to establish as much of a uniform policy as possible.
You mentioned disparity studies. Can you add anything to that as far as like what the scope of those studies might be? You know, who's conducting them? Is it the state DOTs? Is it, and then is it statewide, or what's the scope of the study?
Yeah, you'll have to, excuse me, I'll have to go back and look at that provision of the rule. I spent less time on it, candidly. I'm aware that it's there. And the idea is, again, to look, once you have this newly certified pool of DBEs, then you go through the disparity kind of analysis, or at least capabilities, but there's sort of guidelines in there for what the state, how that process will go for the states. But that's,
but I would assume that would be the DOT, wouldn't it, the state DOT?
Yeah, or whatever the term, unified certifying agency, or whatever the term of art is. But yeah, the states will do that on an individual basis.
And I mean, does that process create an opportunity for the ACEC state chapter in that state to work with the DOT in terms of you know, doing it the right way? I don't know. We're not there yet. Yes, sir.
So really appreciate y'all pulling the information together, the meeting. Looking at pathways forward, how viable is it to utilize SBE and to transition from DBE to SBE?
I think it's viable. I don't know.
Yeah, and that, it's certainly a path that a number of states have articulated an intent to move to. You know, the defining feature of DBE is obviously in its name, this social and economic disadvantaged piece. And that is maintained in the new rule. And that's why you have that personal net worth cap along with the sort of evidence of economic disadvantage. So that's different from just a straight small business goal. But until the underlying program goes that way, as Steve mentioned earlier, we would expect there would continue to be a DBE piece. But whether and to what extent a state's, and I guess that's the other piece of the change in terms of talking about replacing race conscious and race neutral with DBE conscious and DBE neutral, it may be that a state finds that its state small business program is enough to meet the goals of the DBE program, and they don't even need a DBE conscious, so-called, it used to be race conscious and race neutral. They may not even need a DBE conscious program if there are other underlying or new expanded small business program meets those same goals. That's a possibility.
So I guess I have a couple things. One of them did have to do with the SBE. So, I mean, there is the SBE on the federal end, and at least in Maryland, kind of, if you're certified as DBE, you automatically kind of meet all the same criteria as SBE, since it just has fewer criteria. But for us, they only treat the SBE as for where you would prime the contract, versus the DBE goal is as a subcontracting goal. So I guess wondering if that's just a Maryland preference to treat it that way, or if it is mandated that SBE must be prime. I guess if it could be as a sub opportunity, then it seems like that could be a substitution, right, to be used.
Does anybody want to comment on that, or do other states handle that differently?
California also has a SBE goal on state-funded projects. If there is a piece of federally funded projects, it brings in the DBE requirement as a sub. So the SBE and DBE are both for subcontractor opportunities.
And then if I can get my phone to wake back up. I guess there was, in the rule changes that were made last year, there as part of the streamlining process, I guess the time frame was shortened as far as how long the UCPs have to evaluate applications. So the question would be, is there, you know, what time frame is going to be involved in this reevaluation? Is it a time frame if it was a brand new application? Is it some other time frame that, you know, once I submit my narrative, how long do they have to come back and give me a decision?
Did the interim rule even speak to that?
I'll have to double check. I don't know if the rule changes or speaks to that piece of it. All I know is they suspend the current program until this new certification process is in place. And there's some verbiage about making that as efficient as pragmatic as possible. But there's no timelines on that component. But once that's in place, I'm not sure if it speaks to the requirement to process the application in any kind of with any kind of deadline. I don't think, but I can check.
But it sort of begs the question that if the community generally likes the time frame established in the rulemaking last year, is that one of our recommendations going forward under this new policy, perhaps?
I mean, I guess my perspective, anyone else can chime in, would be to have a shorter time frame. Yeah. They're not evaluating a complete application. In the reevaluation, they'd be evaluating a single component. So it shouldn't be that they get afforded the entire time frame for just evaluating one piece of an application.
Mm-hmm.
And if there could be a limitation placed on that, then at least, because I guess there's also the requirement that they cannot start or restart goal setting until everyone has been recertified. If we have very long time frames for recertification, certain jurisdictions would just never reach that stage.
Right.
So if we can get any tightening up of the time frame to get us to the point where we can restart things, that would be beneficial. And then also running from that, how do you define that you've reevaluated everyone? Because it may be that some people who are currently certified say, screw it, I'm not going to bother with it. So are you going to hold up saying, I'm done recertifying when some people have decided not to reapply?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know when you can kick into that portion?
Yeah, good points. No, that's great input, and clearly probably a topic we need to weigh in.
And I think a question from someone back there about the last bullet may also extend to whether primes can just drop subs. So once the goal is gone and just say, hey, we'll just zero out everyone's balance and, you know, we'll keep that money moving forward. And so whether it should kind of fall to, well, the contract was written with this percentage distribution with everybody, and even though there's no goal and we're not tracking it, you know, with, you know, the all the reporting requirements, do we still kind of keep the obligation that was established in the contract of the percentage distributions?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And that's another issue that kind of falls into that sort of continuity of existing contracts, even at that level. I will say this, we did, with the help of the Research Institute, we polled the CEOs of the companies, small, medium, and large. And, you know, as you can imagine, there was some differing opinions on set-asides in general and DBEs, but a lot of commonality in terms of, you know, hey, let's try to figure out a transition that works and is least burdensome. But also, you know, really encouraging feedback in terms of the importance of that teaming, and that teaming is going to continue regardless of the future of this program. So that was encouraging to see. Yes, sir.
Yes, Steve. So just, you know, I'm going to double down on what the gentleman was talking about, and similar to what you were saying, talking about a model or a path forward. I mean, New Jersey DOT did this, I don't know the exact date, probably 15 years ago. A lot of people still refer to, and my company's headquartered in New Jersey, even though we work on the Eastern Seaboard, but a lot of folks still refer to it as a DBE program, but they took out, based on a lawsuit that happened 15, 18 years ago, they took out the race and the gender criteria out. They renamed it ESBE. So you can rename and call it anything you want, but there was really, the transition was extremely smooth. All the DBEs who met the other criteria, which was basically dropping that race and gender criteria out, and you're meeting the other two criteria, size of the company and the annual billing and your net worth and all that, you're automatically certified as an ESBE by signing just one piece of paper, right? And the new folks could come in as an ESBE that couldn't come in at the DBE program, but the program kept the DBEs who met the other criteria, maybe increased the pool, that's fair, and the primes didn't have to hunt or companies didn't go out of business, so to say. So I think there is a path forward. Obviously, it all depends how much appetite the folks in Washington have for it, right? But I just wanted to chime in and just repeat pretty much the same thing which was said, but I wanted to make sure that everybody knew that there was at least one state, very prominent state, that has been doing it for at least 15 years.
Yeah, no,
Thank you. I
think I heard that, and are there some model, is there a template there, perhaps, that might provide some recommendations for DOT, sure.
Okay, a couple points. First, the offices that do the certification, we're certified in about 10 or 12 different states, and I didn't know that what you guys did in 2024, which I so appreciate, but we're in the midst. We had an owner resign, and then also our person who handled all the DBE certifications left around the same time. So we're kind of in a mess right now, like cutting everything up to, we're doing a lot of recertifications right now and sending out the letter and a lot of paperwork. Not one single certifying entity has mentioned any of this. You know, I mean, I already knew about it, of course, but like they're just processing, oh, we need some more information. They're just processing everything, just same as it always was. And I figure we should just keep going. So I think to process all of this and with the time, I loved what you said about the time frame and setting a date, but these offices are usually very understaffed and it takes already a long time. And I think they're going to have to hire more people to do this. And it's going to be kind of counter to their philosophy.
But yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
That's where
interesting.
I am.
Well, in fairness to those agencies, I mean, like I said, this just came out, you know, so it is still kind of slowly percolating out there. The DOT, state DOTs are still getting their arms around this. So I'm sure you will hear soon. But all right. Hand up over there.
Yeah, hi. I've heard over the last couple of days that we're really hoping to have a soft landing for these DBEs, and we really appreciate that. But as it is right now, it appears that it's at least 2 years before a DBE program will be back. You know, you have a year of certification and a year of goal setting. So is there a way that we could advocate for just a small business program from the federal government that's applied to all states equally and with the same, you know, criteria that we were so excited to have last year of, you know, the net revenue change and the personal net worth change, and just call it a day? At least that would be a softer landing than waiting 2 years for additional goals to be set.
No, that's a good idea. And it's the kind of thing, as Matt indicated, the other element of the response process is that potential legislative one. And, you know, with us and other organizations maybe going to Congress and looking for temporary solutions that kind of ease the transition, it could be very much something like what you just described. Yes, sir.
I think that's a really good point. I see this and I can see future litigation, and there's a lot of uncertainty here, so who knows what it's going to happen. But I think being proactive is a good thing in this point, because this is just the federal side. You know, if you get a Supreme Court decision, that's going to be very disruptive, and that's going to apply to the entire country.
Oh, yeah. No, it's starting with USDOT, but we're just assuming this will percolate around, and it will impact every state program that is similarly organized. So, yes, back there. Sir.
So I've been trying to sit here and puzzle out what social disadvantage means, you know, an abusive family, drug addiction, homelessness. I don't have any idea what social disadvantage means, but I do know what economic disadvantage means. It's firmly defined right now. It's a certain amount with your assets and the business taken away and your home and some things, right? So the economic portion of this two-part is established and it's simple. So would a path forward just be to request that the social part be dropped in its entirety while they're dropping the race and the gender?
Potentially. I think we're and others, other organizations would like some clarity as to what the department has in mind there. And, you know, does it enhance the arguments of existing DBEs to remain DBEs? And do we want to keep it? You're asking the right questions. I think this is still, we're just looking for more clarity as to what all this means. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Randall Young with JMT. I'm in one of those states, South Carolina, that has, as of today, changed their current opportunities that are out there right now to take out the DBE goal. So that was just, if you want to add another state to that list. But one question I have is probably very close to the question that was just asked, is based on the interpretation from the Mid-America Milling argument, the arguments that are made, do you have a guess, if you will, educated guess on what that new standard for demonstrating economic and social disadvantage, do we have a guess of what that may look like based on what the arguments were from that earlier case?
Yeah, well, I mean, the case was really more centered on the rebuttable presumption of social and economic disadvantage based on the racial categories and on gender that are provided explicitly in the statute, that if you fall into these categories, you are automatically presumed to have faced hardship, and so you automatically qualify. So that was the scrutiny from a constitutional standard was based on that rebuttable presumption. I'm an attorney, but I don't want to do a deep dive on constitutional law, but you know, there's certain things, if the government is going to discriminate based on race, there is a very high standard that you have to meet to justify that. And you have to have very specific kind of program parameters and outcomes and so on and so forth to address a very specific component. Otherwise it's not fair to do that. That's the kind of, the court didn't really get into, as far as I know, outside of that rebuttable presumption, the question of what constitutes economic disadvantage or not. They did say, the preliminary ruling was basically saying the disparity studies that DOT and the Congress cite as justification for the program were not adequate. So they did take issue with the facts that were presented on behalf of the DOT at the time. But beyond that, they don't get into the substance of the question of these things. So,
but I mean, having said all that, it does sort of, you have to wonder. I mean, the judge is clearly working on something, and you know, he's evaluating arguments from both sides, and that may have bearing on USDOT's policy, which kind of then begs the question, well, why did USDOT do this, you know, knowing that the judge wasn't finished yet? So, and again, that raises the potential for legal challenges, and certainly almost creates the certainty that additional guidance will be coming out from the department depending on what that judge says. So we'll be watching that closely. Sean.
I think it's really one really good for us to note. Maybe you can explain a little bit more. That three-prong approach is really important. From a case study, from the actual case piece, it's run by the Justice Department. We, as ACEC, have pretty much little say as to what's going to happen with that. Obviously, we have a lot of influence over the reauthorization as much as we can, because that's what we do on the advocacy side. And the last piece, the interim rule can't go against the law, correct? Right, so there's we can't go through and change the authorized legislative DBE program. And I know I read the whole 58-page rule around the disparity studies and everything else. And one of the things I think, as we think through different things with reciprocity that's already in the law and this re-upping and recertification, maybe a blue state goes through and recertifies and then it becomes universal reciprocation. And these are the things, if we could get from our members ideas, I think, to how we could make it a softer landing or different things like that to benefit the members and the business would be good. I don't know if you want to comment a little bit more on just what we can do in those different, because there's all three branches of the government that are doing this at this point.
Yeah, and as we've talked about, there may be a play with Congress in terms of smoothing the transition piece, depending on if and when litigation unfolds, do we have a role to play there? But I think we will have opportunities, you know, again, in partnership with state DOTs, in partnership with other stakeholders, to try to influence how USDOT, the kind of guidance that it puts out subsequent to what it's already put out. And that's what we're focused on. So, other questions, comments? Okay.
Good afternoon, Steve. I do have some concerns on the DBE program and the potential effect to other small firms. And so let me explain myself. This will be a threat to DBEs as a whole in, you know, continuing forward and their business model. But for the smaller firms, which is the bulk of our membership, we strategically partner with these firms because they carry services that we have made strategic decisions not to have under our roof because we don't do the volume of work to make that happen and be viable. But it also enables us, those strategic partnerships, puts us on an equal footing with larger firms in the competitive market under QBS. These wholesale changes, because the larger firms also partner with the DBEs in order to realize their disadvantage percentage, and it threatens their business model and the viability of these smaller firms that we've had strategic partnerships for years in to remain competitive. My concern is this is a potential long-term, a cascading effect that's going to just further narrow the market, the marketplace into larger firm model, as opposed to the bulk of our membership, which is more oriented towards small firms, giving us an opportunity in this kind of forum to have a larger voice than we would otherwise singularly.
Yeah, yeah. No, those are great points, and I think that's the sort of thing that might reinforce some of the recommendations that we put forward in how this transition and how the certification happens and all of the things that we've been talking about here. It's that dynamic, and I think a couple others that we've talked about that reinforce the need for doing this right. I think I saw another hand go up.
I wondered about maybe procedurally, what does interim mean? I guess, and are they required to issue then a final? I guess, do we, and part of what I'm wondering is back to my original question was just, do we expect the feds to actually provide more description than what's already there? Or should we just expect that the DOTs would?
Well, certainly hoping they are. I think there's an expectation. I think I saw Beth Bauer had sent something from Indiana DOT, and I think I've seen it with other DOTs, where there's certainly an expectation on the state DOT's part there's going to be subsequent guidance. And I don't know if the interim and that expectation gets back to the fact that the court case has not fully played out yet, and a complete set of guidance and direction from the judge has come out yet. So I'm speculating perhaps a bit here, but I'm assuming that's the case, that this was the initial tranche of guidance to be clarified and supplemented later.
So interim doesn't require, I guess, a final rule to be then issued. That's different.
I think that's correct. Yeah. So, and not to do a deep dive on the Administrative Procedures Act or regulatory law, but I mean the normal process is you've got an advance notice of proposed rulemaking or request for information, or at least a notice of proposed rulemaking, and then a comment period, evaluation of public input and feedback and changes and so forth, and then the issuance of a final rule. What DOT did this time is skip over all of that and just proceed straight to the end. Their argument being, because this is violating the Constitution and that's clear, we need to make changes immediately. But there's no, under the APA, you can't just go straight to a final rule. You have to do this so-called interim final rule with a purported comment period, but unless they change anything, it would still consider to be final. There's no additional step that's necessary to finalize what they published on the 3rd. It is final. It's just quote unquote interim for 30 days. But there is, that does give them the latitude to make adjustments if needed. But then they could also publish, they put out 4 pages of guidance, which was in a lot of respects was a very, very short summation of what was already in the rule. Didn't provide a lot of new or additional information, but that's where we would like to see additional material come forth.
So Steve, to respond to his question from Indiana, I know our DOT, since that surprise ruling last week, is working on criteria to satisfy the interim final rule for the current pool of DBE firms to recertify that will satisfy the questions or those criteria in there about what does it mean to be able to, what is the narrative. So they're going to try to establish some criteria and some guidelines that the firms would then be able to follow that would help them on their navigation to get to the end. So initially the plan was just to grandfather them all in, and then the rug got pulled out from under them last week. So they're hoping to have that done within a few weeks. And so hopefully that occurs and we can share that with the national staff and we'll see how that works out.
And Beth, do you expect that you all may have an opportunity to comment on some of that guidance that they develop?
They're working with us. It's
okay,
a partnership.
Good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think we touched this point before. I suspect there's other DOTs that are probably starting the same process. And I think what works for us, if they're going in the right direction and this is a good partnership opportunity with ACEC and the DOTs to do this in a way that's least burdensome and also least disruptive to delivering the program, which is still, an imperative, that's what we're looking for.
Uh-huh. I think it will be great, states like Indiana or any state in the nation, when they have a decision like Indiana is going to have, if they can share it with us,
yeah,
we can share it with the entire United States, basically.
Yeah, and we talked about that with the executive directors over the weekend, and we'll continue to communicate with them, throughout this 30-day period, so we can grab as many good ideas to highlight. And again, it coming from both DOTs and industry, hopefully that's persuasive.
So presumably all the state DOTs are the enacting agencies for the DBE rules, like Caltrans in California, correct? So has AASHTO weighed in on this? Have they even woke up to this yet?
They've woke up to them. I mean, you've talked to them, but and we've been talking to them over the last couple of months. I think they're in the same place we are. They're reacting to this, and they're probably communicating with their members, and hopefully they're also gathering those good ideas and synthesizing those. And, you know, we're going to be continuing to stay in touch with them and work with them and coordinate as much as possible, again, just to kind of get through this in a smooth way as possible. So you can see a hand up back there.
I was just going to share that at least California's DOT, which is Caltrans to us, they did send out some guidance this afternoon, and we were the recipient of it, and they included almost all the local agencies in this specific district, as well as their local council of government or transportation authority. And they basically said that any signed contract on or after October 3rd must not have a DBE goal or a DBE goal compliance requirements. They also say that contracts under award cannot be awarded with a goal, and they are urging local agencies to consult their legal teams on how to address the situation on a case-by-case basis. They said a couple options that are out there are, one, that they can award their current bids to the lowest bidder with no consideration to the DBE responsiveness or qualifications, or they could re-advertise with no goal. And so basically they just ended it saying that, you know, everything is coming out, it's very new, they don't have real detailed guidance at this stage, and to consult with their legal counsel.
All right. Well, that sounds like sort of interim reaction that a lot of DOTs are doing in sort of restating current policy. I would say if anybody is having their services bid, we need to push back against that, because that runs, you know, qualifications-based selection did not get invalidated in this court decision, so that's still in place. And so let us know if that happens. Yes, sir.
I was just going to ask, can ACEC put together a website and capture information that's organized by state? Because obviously you've got something that just came out this afternoon. I got something from South Carolina from one of my clients this morning. It would be nice if we'd be able to go to one spot instead of all of us trying to Google search and figure out what's happening.
Great idea.
I realize you're probably to a degree going to be relying on us to feed you that information, but it'd be really helpful to have kind of an authoritative source of information.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great suggestion, and the state organizations are really good about forwarding that information to us. And you know, we just set something up. We haven't talked about the government shutdown and other calamities that we're dealing with right now, but we set up a very similar resource page with links to all the federal agencies, so you could it's a one-stop shop for you. We can certainly do the same thing here.
Hey, Steve,
suggestion.
Do you have a slide that has your contact information on it?
We do, yeah. I was just sort of waiting for the questions to kind of wind down, and but yeah, if we can go to the next slide. Matt's and my contact information. I would put the emphasis on the email addresses in terms of getting a hold of us. In terms of additional, ideas going forward, what are the sort of things that we want to capture in letters? What issues have we not talked about that we need to seek clarity on? Please reach out to us, with your thoughts, even if it's to reiterate some points today. What we would love to do is, if we hear from you, we'd like to make you a part of the working group that we are forming on this issue and keep in touch with you. Of course, our state executives will be a part of that working group. And like I said, we will continue to coordinate with groups like AASHTO and other stakeholders, to the extent that we can work together to a common purpose here. And then we're going to probably, I think I mentioned this at the front end, but we'll probably do a version of this as a virtual webinar and get feedback from the rest of the folks out there in the country that are impacted by this. We want to make sure that we hear from them as well and they hear from us. So,
Yeah, and just to add on to this, and Robert's comment made me think, and I mentioned some of the educational program that we've done. I mean, beyond the advocacy side and staying in touch on program changes, for in terms of business resources and education, if there are specific topics or things that you want us to be attentive to and provide as we all navigate this. I mean, you know, we would love to hear that as well. And we've got a deep pool of service providers and expert consultants who can help provide and continue to educate and inform you all as you make these business decisions going forward. So beyond the advocacy and regulatory and legislative stuff, which obviously we're going to work on, we'll also love to get input for our education team on, you know, what kind of programming we need to provide at the association level too.
No, that's a great point. I mean, this is going to end up being a whole of organization effort. And, I mean, I can easily see a webinar focused on that personal narrative and the economic data and just, you know, best practices, you know, to put forward your best case for qualifying as a DBE. And there'll be other ideas, I'm sure, that will stem from this where we're going to want to do, you know, bring in some outside experts and do some online education for you all. So, this will be an effort that goes well beyond this initial comment period. Any final thoughts, questions, advice?
Hi, thanks so much for this. It was very informative. We went through something similar at the beginning of the year with loss of federal contracts for international federal assistance. Foreign assistance, and one of the things that SBAIC did was send a lot of surveys out to firms that were impacted through contract cancellations, and so like trying to document the financial impact of these changes to firms. And I'm wondering if like through the research arm of ACEC, collecting data on the financial impact to all the member companies or the industry at large in terms of lost opportunities, or potentially, because this is going to be a long-term impact, right? It's going to take years to follow through, but also firms closing, closure of firms, loss of representation of women and minority-owned business in the marketplace. So, you know, that's something that we could start now and make the data collection easier, and also it feeds into advocacy when you talk to particularly the House representatives and saying you are losing firms, you're losing taxpayer dollars within your constituency.
Yeah, that's a great idea, and I think that's certainly something that we could do. It would be great if we could do it in partnership with SBA or other willing partners. Maybe they're not quite so willing right now, but you know, they're and this kind of feeds back into the legislative options available to us. You know, you do kind of wonder the political impact here. I mean, these tend to be small firms, and the impact of small firms and lawmakers in both parties like small firms. They like small business, and they don't want to see bad things happen to them. So that dynamic we haven't even realized yet. And so anyway, but great suggestion, and we'll see what we can do going forward. So, any other final thoughts, questions? Before we wrap up, all right. Well, we'll stick around here for a bit if you want to chat one-on-one. Otherwise, reach out to us, please, so we can make you part of our brain trust on this issue, and we'll continue to work together and shape this as best as we can. So thank you so much for being here.